You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm J. Kyle Sullivan. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Noam Chomsky is Institute Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The world-renowned linguist has lectured and written extensively on the subject, as he has on philosophy, politics, international affairs, and numerous others. Chomsky was invited by the UMass Amherst Political Economy Research Institute to speak on the existential threats posed by nuclear weaponry and climate change. His talk, Prospects for Survival, was recorded on April 13, 2017, at UMass Amherst.
I've been intrigued for quite a few years by an interesting debate that took place about 20 years ago, I guess, between Carl Sagan, well-known astrophysicist, and Ernst Mayr, who was the grand old man of American biology. They were debating the likelihood that we could find extraterrestrial intelligence. And Sagan, arguing from the point of view of an astrophysicist, calculated the number of planets, roughly like ours, and concluded that it's highly probable that there is intelligent life out there. Mayr took a different stand. He was arguing from the point of view of a biologist, and he said, we have only one sample, Earth. There have been 50 billion species on Earth, and we have a good deal of evidence about what factors contribute to biological success and survival of a species. That survival means roughly how many of them are there around. And he says, when we look, we discover that the species that are successful are either those that mutate very quickly, like bacteria, or the ones that just keep to a fixed niche, ecological niche, and never move, no matter what happens, like beetles. And as we move up the scale of what we call intelligence, success is less and less. By the time you get to primates, there are very few of them. In fact, up until recently, humans, who've been around for about 200,000 years, were very scattered, just like higher apes. So humans in the last couple of hundred years are a sort of statistical blip which doesn't change the pattern. So he concludes, Mayr concludes, that the history of life on Earth refutes the claim that it's better to be smart than to be stupid. He also adds that the average lifespan of a species is about 100,000 years. Modern humans, are about 200,000 years. So we're in a good position to test the thesis. The Indian writer Amitav Ghosh just came out with a book called The Great Derangement, Climate Change and the Unthinkable. And his point is that our failure to deal with the most awesome challenge in human history, with the possible exception of nuclear weapons, is indeed a true derangement and rather painful evidence for Ernst Mayr's thesis, unfortunately. As we all should be well aware, these are the two existential challenges that overshadow everything else. Their severity and their imminence is illustrated graphically by the famous doomsday clock of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Every year, a group of physicists, strategic analysts, and others consider the state of the world and set the time, the minute hand, on the doomsday clock, asking how close it is to midnight. Midnight means we've proven Meyer's thesis. It's better to be stupid than smart. The doomsday clock was established at the beginning of the nuclear age. The first year was 1947. At that point, it was set at 7 minutes to midnight. In 1953, the United States and Russia detonated hydrogen bombs, and the minute hand moved to 2 minutes to midnight. It's oscillated since. In the years 2015 and 2016, it was moved forward to 3 minutes to midnight. That's as high as it had been since the early 1980s, when there was indeed a major, major war scare. The reasons for moving it forward the last couple of years were the mounting threat of nuclear war and the failure to deal with climate change, which had not been calculated into the analysis before that. And here's what the statement said, their statement. It said, the probability of global catastrophe is very high, and the actions needed to reduce the risks of disaster must be taken very soon. That was 2016. A couple of months ago, at the outset of the Trump term, the analysts moved it again. They found, in their words, the danger to be even greater, the need for action more urgent. It is 2.5 minutes to midnight. The clock is ticking. Global danger looms. That's the closest it's been to terminal disaster since 1953, when, as I mentioned, the two superpowers tested H-bombs, which can destroy human life instantaneously. Well, actually, that earlier brush with disaster, 1953, terminal disaster, merits more attention than it's received. There is an obvious question about it. Was it avoidable? And what efforts were made to avoid it? There's an answer to that question, and it's quite startling and fraught with grim lessons for today. Let's go back to 1950. The United States was remarkably secure, more unbelievably so. It controlled the entire hemisphere. It controlled both oceans. It controlled the opposite sides of both oceans. It had overwhelming economic, industrial, military superiority. It largely controlled the major industrial states. Of course, every other major industrial society had been severely harmed or almost destroyed by the Second World War. The United States had, in fact, economy had, in fact, benefited greatly from the war. Industrial production practically quadrupled. The stage was set for the great economic expansion of the 50s and the 60s. Well, there was a potential threat to U.S. security. Didn't exist, but it was going to exist sooner or later. International continental ballistic missiles, ICBMs, which would, of course, have nuclear warheads. That was would become a devastating threat to the United States. In fact, it was about the only security threat at the time. So how is it dealt with? Actually, there is an authoritative study of this by McGeorge Bundy, who was the National Security Advisor for Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and he was given access he did a history of strategic weapons. He was given access to the highest level classified material. And if you read through the book, there's a kind of a casual statement about halfway through, which is one of the most remarkable statements I've ever read in the literature on international affairs and strategic issues. He says, I am aware of no serious contemporary proposal around 1950, in or out of government, that ballistic missiles should somehow be banned by agreement. And then he goes on to the next topic. So in other words, there was apparently no thought at all in or out of government of trying internal documents, classified documents, public ones, no thought of trying to avert the sole serious threat to the United States, the threat of utter destruction. And there's a lesson there. It means that for planners, the security of the population is of very marginal concern, even security from utter destruction. Rather, the institutional imperatives of state power prevail. Now, there's lots of talk about security, but it doesn't mean your security. It means the security of power, corporate and state power. Let's also, quite apart from the remarkable character of this discovery, is the fact that there isn't any comment on it. Nobody seems to care, as if it's kind of obvious. Why should the security of the population be of any concern to planners, even their survival? And it's not an isolated example by any means. So let's look a little further. Were there possibilities at the time for some kind of negotiation that could have averted the threat of instant destruction of the United States, the only security threat we faced? Well, we can't be sure, of course, because the apparent opportunities that existed were simply ignored. And there were possibilities. So, for example, in 1952, Joseph Stalin, still alive, made a pretty remarkable public offer. He offered to permit Germany to be unified on one condition, that it not join NATO, a hostile military alliance, which is not terribly surprising given that Germany alone had just virtually wiped out Russia a few years ago, as it had during the First World War. He also mentioned the prospect of elections, which of course the communists would lose. This offer was known. It was discussed by one of the most prominent and respected political analysts, James Warburg, but he was simply ridiculed. How could it possibly be of any interest? And whenever the idea was mentioned in later years, it was simply dismissed with ridicule. Recently, the Russian archives have been opened, and it turns out that the offer might have been serious. The bitterly anti-communist Soviet scholar, Adam Ulam, Harvard, he takes the status of Stalin's proposal to be what he calls an unresolved mystery. Washington wasted little effort in flatly rejecting Moscow's initiative, he writes, on grounds that were embarrassingly unconvincing, leaving open the basic question: was Stalin genuinely ready to sacrifice the newly created German Democratic Republic, Communist East Germany, on the altar of real democracy, with consequences for world peace and for American security that could have been enormous? One of the most prominent Cold War scholars, Melvin Leffler, writes now that scholars who have studied released Soviet archives were surprised to discover that Lavrenty Beria, the sinister, brutal head of the secret police, proposed that the Kremlin offer the West a deal on the unification and neutralization of Germany, agreeing to sacrifice the East German communist regime to reduce East-West tensions and improve internal political and economic conditions in Russia, opportunities that were squandered in favor of securing German participation in NATO. Those of you who are paying attention to current affairs can draw some conclusions. Well, was the offer real? We can't be sure. What we can be sure of is that what mattered was global power, not security for the population, even security from instant destruction. And if you look over the long record, over and over, you find that this is one of the starkest and most consistent lessons of policy formation. A lot of talk of security. It's not security of the population, which is at most a marginal concern. It's much too large a topic to review in detail here, but I'd really urge you to look into it. It's quite illuminating. Let's just proceed a few more years into the 50s and 60s to see how these ideas play out. Stalin died a couple of years later, 1953. After a little while, he was replaced by Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev understood that the Soviet Union could not possibly compete with the United States economically or militarily. It was much too far less developed society, had undergone horrifying near destruction during the Second World War, as several times before. He therefore made an offer to the United States that both sides should sharply cut back weapons, offensive weapons. And in fact, when the Kennedy administration came in, Khrushchev actually did so unilaterally, sharp cutback in offensive weapons, asking the United States to reciprocate. Well, here's what happened. I'll quote one of the most respected U.S. international relations scholars, Kenneth Waltz, died recently. Waltz writes that the Kennedy administration undertook the largest strategic and conventional peacetime military buildup the world has yet seen, even as Khrushchev was trying at once to carry through a major reduction in the conventional forces and to follow a strategy of minimum deterrence. And we did so even though the balance of strategic weapons greatly favored the United States. Once again, the Kennedy decision harmed national security while enhancing state power. And if you notice some analogs today, you're not mistaken. Well, how serious the threat was in 1960 was soon revealed in October 1962. Kennedy advisor, historian Arthur Schlesinger called the most dangerous moment in history, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And as the facts about that have come out over the years, the story is really harrowing. President Eisenhower, it turns out, had sub-delegated authority to use nuclear weapons to commanders. Dan Ellsberg, who was involved closely at the Rand Corporation in strategic planning at the time, has gone through all the documents, investigated on the field, has a book coming out in which he describes in detail how low a level it was possible for even crews to launch nuclear weapons. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, U.S. planes, B-52s with nuclear weapons, were flying constantly, the so-called Chrome Dome missions. The pilots have published memoirs. Turns out that individual bomber crews could have decided to launch nuclear weapons, ending human existence. And the details of that crisis merit really close consideration. They've been very extensively documented from the most credible sources. There was a possible resolution of the crisis, late October 1962. Khrushchev wrote a personal letter to Senator Kennedy, offering a way to settle the crisis at once. The Russians would withdraw the missiles from Cuba, and in return, the United States would withdraw missiles, Jupiter missiles, much more lethal missiles from Turkey. Well, it turns out that the missiles in Turkey were obsolete. a withdrawal order had already been given for them because they were being replaced by invulnerable, much more destructive Polaris submarines. So the question was, in Kennedy's mind, should we end the crisis by having Russia withdraw the missiles from Cuba while we withdraw missiles that we're already withdrawing because we're replacing them by more lethal ones? Kennedy refused. His own subjective probability, as he testified, was that the chance of nuclear war was between a third and a half if he refused, as he did. He had to establish a principle. We have the right to surround them with missiles. They don't have any reciprocal right. Again, security of the population was a minor concern, and that continues right to the present moment, right at the Russian border today. And in fact, it's true of both of the two existential threats. There is an important difference between the two threats. If by some miracle we escape nuclear disaster, and incidentally, a review of the record, which again I urge you to undertake, reveals that it is indeed a near miracle that we've escaped this far. But if we somehow escape, at least we know in principle how to end the plague. We can, in principle, eliminate nuclear weapons. And that's advocated by figures who are hardly doves, like Henry Kissinger and Reagan's Secretary of State George Shultz, the Senate's former leading specialist on nuclear weapons, Sam Nunn, William Perry, well-known former defense secretary, leading specialist on nuclear security. That's nuclear weapons. Global warming is different. It's inexorable. We might pass a point of no return soon, in fact, when the damage that we have done is uncontrollable. Well, looking over this situation, we see that the human species is now undertaking an experiment to answer Meyer's question. Is it better to be smart than stupid? And to examine the course of the experiment, let's just sample a few facts. So let me begin with a recent report last couple of weeks in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the main source for high-level strategic analysis on these issues. There's a recent report in March on the vast nuclear modernization program that was initiated by Obama and is now being expanded under Trump. Now, the report discusses how U.S. nuclear force modernization is undermining the strategic stability on which survival suspends by a very slender thread. I'll quote them. The current modernization programs include revolutionary new technologies that will vastly increase the targeting capability of the U.S. ballistic missile arsenal. This increase in capability is astonishing, boosting the overall killing power of existing U.S. ballistic missile forces by a factor of roughly 3, and it creates exactly what one would expect to see if a nuclear-armed state were planning to have the capacity to fight and win a nuclear war by disarming enemies with a surprise first strike. Russians, of course, know this very well, even without reading the article. Going on with the article, U.S. submarines now patrol with more than 3 times the number of warheads needed to destroy the entire fleet of Russian land-based missiles in their silos. U.S. submarine-based missiles can carry multiple warheads, so hundreds of others now in storage could be added to the submarine-based missile force, making it all the more lethal. All of this has revolutionary impact on military capabilities and important implications for global security. The implications, in fact, are very clear. Russian strategic analysts are, of course, aware that the United States, thanks to these modernization programs, now has the capacity to wipe out their deterrent in a first strike. NATO forces are carrying out provocative maneuvers right at the Russian border. In fact, both sides are carrying out provocative actions. Now, the Russians do not have our sophisticated satellite-based advanced warning systems. They have limited information time if there's a possible attack. And with the Russian deterrent at serious risk because of the nuclear modernization programs at a moment of crisis, and there are many possibilities, the Russian leaders might very well be tempted to undertake a preemptive strike just to have a chance for survival. And that's an act that would end organized human life on Earth. We know that. That's one of many examples of how close we are to answering Ernst Mayr's question. And again, it receives approximately zero attention outside of highly specialized circles. Well, once again, we can ask whether a diplomatic avenue is possible. It surely seems so. Is it being pursued? Not a slightest indication of it, or even discussion of it, exactly like the cases that I was discussing earlier, back to the beginning of the nuclear age. It's not the only case. Right now, if you turn on the television set, you see the frightened debates about the North Korean nuclear threat. North Korea may be poised to launch another nuclear weapon. The North Korean threat is regarded as one of the most severe in the world, and forceful measures are now being considered, in fact being prepared, that could have disastrous consequences. Well, again, is there a possible diplomatic path? Actually, China and North Korea have proposed a negotiated agreement. North Korea will place all nuclear weapons programs on hold, they'll terminate them, and in return, the United States will end hostile military maneuvers on the North Korean border, including flights by nuclear-capable B-52s. And North Koreans, of course, have memories of having had the country completely flattened by U.S. bombing 60 years ago. Well, is that option worth pursuing? Evidently not, for Washington at least. Any thought of exploration of that path has been forcefully rejected, again, with scarcely a word of criticism. Well, there's no time to review the history, but you can do it. It's public. In recent years, there have been several very promising opportunities for agreement to end North Korean nuclear programs, in each case undermined by aggressive U.S. actions. All of this is quite relevant to Mayr's question. Well, let's turn to the other existential threat. On global warming, anyone who's not living under a rock should be aware that the dangers are severe and imminent. So how are we reacting? Here's a recent report from the Business Press. The oil boom is back. The number of oil and gas rigs drilling in the U.S. has almost doubled since bottoming out at the lowest level in more than 75 years of records. While two dozen nations are coordinating to cut oil production and rein in the global supply glut, U.S. producers are moving in the opposite direction. Over the last 4 months, output increased of fossil fuels that is increased by over 500,000 barrels a day. If that rate expansion continues, the shale boom will break new production records by summer. The U.S. now produces 9 billion barrels a day, the record. That illustrates a crucial fact of current history. While the world is taking halting steps towards facing the existential challenge to survival, the U.S., virtually alone, is racing towards destruction and doing so with enthusiasm and dedication. Well, the oil industry, of course, has plenty of help coming from you. The International Monetary Fund reports that the fossil fuel industry manages to extract a $700 billion annual taxpayer subsidy. That's known as the free market here. And the industry doesn't take chances. In last year, 2016, it spent $117 million in campaign contributions while fielding 720 lobbyists in Washington to make sure that Congress gets the message, better do what we want. And apparently, Congress does. There's a recent study in the Washington Post of Republicans in Congress, and it says many Republicans in Congress, contrary to what the leadership says, do recognize the severe threat of climate change, but they won't talk about it because of funding pressures from the fossil fuel industry. Now, this is particularly true since the Citizens United ruling of the Supreme Court opened the doors even wider for a flood of corporate political funding, which means you toe the corporate line or you're out. Actually, these reports from the press are quite typical of the daily fare. Won't sample any more of them, but you can see them every time you open the press. Well, let's continue to review the experiment that humans are undertaking. Just pick a couple of recent dates. Let's take last November 8th. Three events took place last November 8th. One of them was very important. One was extremely important. And the third was utterly astonishing. The least of the three, the least important, was the election in the United States. Plenty of publicity, important, but the least important of the three. The more important by far of the three took place in Morocco. In Marrakesh, Morocco, about 200 nations were participating in a UN-sponsored international conference, COP22 it was called, which was an attempt to put some teeth in the Paris negotiations on climate change of the preceding year. It had been hoped at Paris that they could reach a verifiable treaty on actions to address climate change, but that couldn't be done because of a single barrier. It's called the Republican Party. The Republican Congress in the United States would not accept any verifiable agreements, so Paris negotiations ended with just verbal commitments. The Morocco conference was an attempt to go beyond that, and as it began, it was moving in that direction. On November 8th, there was a report by the World Meteorological Organization, quoting it, it confirms that 2016 was the warmest year on record, a remarkable 1.1 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial period, sharply above the previous record set in 2015, approaching the desired upper limit set in Paris, and goes on with other dire reports. Now, that was November 8th. At that point, the deliberations ended. The electoral results came in from the United States, and the meeting shifted to another question. Can the world survive when the richest, most powerful country in world history, with incomparable advantages, not only is withdrawing from the effort to try to save the world from destruction, but is undertaking a dedicated commitment to race to the precipice as quickly as possible. The countries of the world were looking for a savior, China, looking to China to save the world from the disaster that is being led by the United States. That was the most important event that took place on November 8th. There was also an astonishing event. It wasn't discussed. Astonishing. Silence. The leader of the free world is leading the world to disaster. That's us. The world is looking to China, of all places, to save it. And the reaction here, take a look back, total silence. Utterly astonishing. I can't find words to describe it. Well, that's November 8th. Let's go on to March 1st. On March 1st, a scientific study was released showing that tens of thousands of miles of permafrost in northwest Canada are rapidly melting, along with massive declines, accelerating decline in permafrost in Alaska, Siberia, and Scandinavia. That could lead to a massive release of greenhouse gases, CO2 and methane, which is all being accelerated by an unprecedented Arctic heat wave. And that was the world. And what happened in the United States on March 1st? The Trump administration decided to help the process along by rescinding the methane rule, which limits release of methane from oil and gas drilling sites on federal lands. And it also announced sharp cuts in Environmental Protection Agency staff and programs, even announcing a ban on research. Actually, just this morning, we received some more good news. Turns out that the rate of melting of permafrost has been underestimated by 20%. The already near lethal consequences are worse than we thought. Well, let's go on to March 16th, the world and the United States. The world, a new study appeared, scientific study, on damage to the Great Barrier Reef off Australia. It's one of the world's largest living structures. It's being severely damaged, intensifying, reported by far the most widespread and damaging of recent mass bleaching of coral reefs since 1998, with very wide-ranging disastrous ecological results. That's the world. In the United States, on the same day, the president's budget was released. The Environmental Protection Agency was virtually dismantled. It's now pretty much run by Senator James Inhofe and his associates. He's the leading climate change denier in the Senate. He's also an extreme fundamentalist. His position is that if God is warming the earth, so be it. It would be sacrilegious to interfere with God's will. And that's the least of it. Well, most of the attention's been focused on the EPA, but for action and research on climate, EPA is a small actor. And far more important is the Department of Energy, and its Office of Science under the budget is scheduled to lose $900 million, 20% of its budget. Its $300 million ARPA energy program is eliminated completely. And there are deep cuts in the research programs there and at the EPA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also a 5% cut to NASA's Earth Science budget. It's actually pretty remarkable to observe the intensity of the administration's hatred of unwanted facts. Just 2 days ago, the New York Times reported the concern of climate scientists that the Trump budget cuts, calls for closing down NASA's main missions that monitor the global climate. That's a pittance in the budget. It's a statistical error, practically. But it has a major impact on understanding of what's happening to the world. But it's best not to know what we do not like. That's a guiding principle of the administration and indeed the Republican Party. The budget itself is of unusual savagery, even for the Paul Ryan wing of the Republican establishment, which is effectively running the show behind the facade of the Trump-Spicer Twitter affairs, which are designed to grab the headlines. It's a bitter attack. If you look at the details, it's a bitter attack on the working class and on the poor, while lavishing even more gifts on the wealthy and the corporate sector, along with, I think, what we can describe as a project of Talibanization of America, literally, in accordance with the Bannon, Sessions, DeVos ideal of a society, which they've made explicit, a society based on Judeo-Christian tradition, white supremacy, destruction of the humanities, the arts, public schooling, even medical research. Well, practically every issue of the science journals provides more grim forecasts. There's one recent paper in the journal Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics by noted climate scientist James Hansen, 18 others, compares today's climate with that of 120,000 years ago, when temperatures were only slightly warmer than today. At that time, it turns out there was a sea level rise of 20 to 30 feet when much of the polar ice disintegrated. And the paper predicts not only that, but in the near future, a killer storm stronger than any in modern times, a disintegration of large parts of the polar ice sheets, leading to the melting of huge glaciers, and a rise in the sea sufficient to begin drowning the world's coastal cities before the end of this century. Hansen says we're in danger of handing young people a situation that's out of their control, with precipitous rises in sea level not far down the road and other dire consequences. Now, there are other studies that indicate that climate change is occurring faster than at any time in the past 100 million years, by some estimates far faster. Last year, atmospheric CO2 passed the symbolic level of 400 particles per million, considered a crucial danger point. It's the first time in 4 million years and possibly irreversible. Well, that's only a small sample of many such reports. They appear regularly in the science journals. Sometimes they make it to the major media. Meanwhile, the Republican wrecking ball is systematically dismantling the structures that offer any hope for decent survival. And it's not just Trump. The whole Republican Party leadership at the national level, and indeed at much of the local level. So in North Carolina, a couple of years ago, a scientific study was commissioned by the Coastal Resources Commission, which estimated that the sea level in North Carolina will rise by almost 40 inches by the end of the century. And the Republican-run legislature had a response. It passed a law that barred state and local agencies from developing regulations or planning documents anticipating a rise in sea level. Now, the best comment on this that I saw was by Stephen Kohlberg. He said, "This is a brilliant solution. If your science gives you a result that you don't like, pass a law saying the result is illegal. Problem solved." Unfortunately, that's not a joke. Captures all too well the mentality of the Republican Party leadership. A couple of years ago, Bobby Jindal, the Republican governor of Louisiana, who succeeded in sinking it even deeper into the abyss, He warned Republicans that they're becoming the stupid party. The respected conservative political analysts, Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, described the party as a radical insurgency that has abandoned parliamentary democracy and, for that matter, rationality. And perhaps a simpler characterization is the utterly outrageous charge that they have become the most dangerous organization in world history, dedicated to destruction of the prospects of decent survival. Indeed, an outrageous charge, but is it wrong? Well, I already mentioned Paris 2015 and Marrakesh, Morocco 2016. Let's go back to the 2016 primary campaign. It was pretty surprising in many respects, but primarily because of the attitude of the candidates to climate change. Every single Republican candidate either denied that what is happening is happening, or the sensible moderates like Jeb Bush said, it's all uncertain, but we don't have to do anything about it because we're producing more natural gas thanks to fracking. Or John Kasich, who was supposedly the adult in the room who did at least agree that it's taking place, global warming, but he says, we're going to burn coal in Ohio and we're not going to apologize for it. As for the media, they just ignored it. After all, it's only the most important issue in human history. Those who think it's better in Europe can turn to a recent poll showing that a majority of Europeans want a total ban on immigration from Muslim-majority countries. That's including the people in Bangladesh, tens of millions of whom are going to flee from the coastal plains as the sea level rises, creating a refugee crisis of the kind that we can't even imagine. The general idea is, first we destroy them, then we punish them for trying to escape from the ruins, and we call it a refugee crisis. In Europe, when thousands drown in the Mediterranean fleeing from Africa, where Europe, after all, has a certain history. Same with us in Central America. In fact, the refugee crisis is a serious moral, cultural crisis in the West, here and in Europe. Well, let's go to one final date, one of the most important dates of human history, the end of World War II. It was a moment of joy. It was a moment of horror, the dawn of the nuclear age. I can remember well my own feelings when the grim news was announced on August 6th, horror at the events and their import, and astonishment that so few people seemed to care about the enormity of what had just happened, or that we had entered into what may soon be the final era of human existence, the nuclear age. Mentioned the doomsday clock, 7 minutes to midnight. Well, it turns out that we not only entered the nuclear age at that time, but as was not then known, we also entered a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, a geological epoch in which human activity is dramatically changing the environment. Now, there have been debates about the inception of the Anthropocene, but it's been pretty much settled by the World Geological Society, which settled on the end of World War II, partly because of the radioactive elements that were being dispersed across the planet by nuclear bomb tests, other consequences of human action, including a significant increase in greenhouse emissions. So the nuclear age and the Anthropocene coincide, all of which raises the lingering question, is it better to be smart than stupid? We only have a few years to try to answer that question. Well, how are we answering it? I mentioned a couple examples. There are a few more to think about. One step was George W. Bush's abrogation of the ABM treaty, anti-ballistic missile treaty. It's followed now by ABM installations near the Russian border. The alleged reason is defense against non-existent Iranian nuclear missiles. Nobody believes that. Russia has very good reason to regard those installations as a first strike weapon. It's a particularly severe threat now in the light of the information I just quoted about U.S. nuclear modernization, which makes it possible for the U.S. to wipe out their deterrent. Well, the next step after abrogation of the ABM treaty was offering NATO membership to Ukraine in 2008. That's the Russian geostrategic heartland. They'll never tolerate it, of course, efforts pursued by Obama and Clinton. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is now up for grabs. It would at least end nuclear tests, which would be a considerable step forward. Can't go into force until it's ratified by the three crucial holdouts, China, Israel, and the United States. The major nuclear powers, the U.S. and Russia, are both expanding arsenals in very dangerous ways. One of the U.S. proposals is tactical nukes that can be scaled down to battlefield use by commanders on the scene with very likely rapid escalation that, of course, leads to termination. And the flashpoints are becoming much more serious, particularly on the Russian border. And it's important to remember it's the Russian border, it's not the Mexican border. That's a result of expansion of NATO right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, in violation of verbal promises to Gorbachev that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. That was the phrase, meaning East Germany, if Gorbachev agreed to unification of Germany within NATO, a hostile military alliance. There's recent archival work by a young diplomatic historian, Joshua Schifrinson, which very strongly suggests that President Bush, the first Bush, and his Secretary of State, James Baker, were consciously deceiving Gorbachev. Gorbachev's vision of a European common home, a security system from Brussels to Vladivostok, with no military alliances, that's unfortunately a fading dream. George Kennan and other senior statesmen had warned early on that NATO expansion is what Kennan called a tragic mistake, a policy error of historic proportions. It's now leading to rising tensions on the traditional invasion route through which Russia was virtually destroyed twice during the past century by Germany alone, and the risk of nuclear war is not slight. Well, as for global warming, we're answering Meyer's question by unilateral efforts, unilateral withdrawal from the world's efforts to address the crisis, replacing them with a dedicated race to the precipice even more rapidly by sharply increasing fossil fuel use, including coal, refusing promised subsidies to poorer countries to develop nuclear energy, dismantling the regulatory apparatus so that profits can boom along with threats to survival. And we cannot stress too strongly the enormity of the fact that the United States is alone in the world in this respect since November 8th. And the no less astonishing fact that this extraordinary development barely registers in the information system, should have screaming headlines and be the most prominent issue in the academic intellectual world, which is more evidence about the great derangement. Well, outside of the world center of devastation and destruction, which is right here, some things are being done. Not enough by any means, but not negligible, and an indication of what is possible. So Denmark is aiming to reach 100% renewable energy within 20 years in all sectors by 2050. Germany, which is the most successful state capitalist economy, has tripled renewable energy for electricity in the past decade, aims to increase it to almost half by 2025 and more than 80% by 2050, and by then to have reduced greenhouse gas emissions by 80 to 90% of 1990 levels. China is still a huge polluter, but it's also well in the lead in production of solar panels, development of advanced solar technology. In the United States, Hawaii passed a law mandating that all the state's electricity will come from renewable sources no later than 2045, and several Massachusetts Democrats have filed a bill, SD 1932, requiring that the state use 100% renewable energy by 2035, mandating elimination of all fossil fuels by 2050, so that would be 100% renewables. San Diego is the first large city planning to run on 100% renewable energy, cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2035, and that happens to be a bipartisan effort. The Republican mayor endorsed the action plan that was unanimously approved by the Democrat-controlled city council. In a period when the federal government is in the hands of bulls in the china shop, states and cities can do quite a lot, so could the federal government if it's in the right hands. One of Hillary Clinton's programs was to try to shift all households to renewable energy in 4 years. It's quite feasible, could create a great many jobs, along with weatherization, other forms of conservation. Federal regulations in recent years have had some positive effects, counterbalanced, unfortunately, with support for fossil fuel production. There's a lot more like this. Not enough, but it's an indication of what can be done, and it can. Harvey Michaels, who's the research director of energy management at MIT Sloan School, has shown in some detail how ambitious but feasible measures, not far beyond those now being contemplated internationally, could meet the goal of keeping global temperatures below 2 degrees centigrade, regarded as the super danger point. Nuclear physicist Ernest Moniz, who was the director of the Department of Energy under Obama, has recently produced figures about declining costs for clean energy technologies that lead him to conclude that climate change may have inspired the energy revolution, but price makes it inevitable, and maybe even in time, with enough effort. Well, I mentioned that the federal government has turned into a wrecking machine, but states and cities can still do a lot. Same is true for all of us. There are real efforts of education and organization that can be faced. Now, there are major challenges, no doubt, but we shouldn't forget that there are rays of hope. I mentioned some of the efforts being made by governments around the world to address the crises, some states and localities here. Not enough, but an indication of what's possible. And there are other reasons for optimism. Actually, one of them has just been reported by Fox News. They ran a poll of popularity of political figures in the United States. In first place, by a huge margin, was Bernie Sanders. That's Fox News, notice. And it's even more true among the young, who are the hope of the future. Now, there are, in fact, ample opportunities if we grasp them, and that means if people like you grasp them, which all brings us back to Ernst Mayr's question, is it better to be smart than stupid? It's a question for you to ponder, and like it or not, for you to answer, and without too much of a delay. Thank you.
That was Noam Chomsky, linguist, author, and political activist, speaking on April 13th, 2017 at UMass Amherst. You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection at NEPR.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For New England Public Radio, I'm J. Kyle Sullivan.